Time Across podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined today by Christian Sweezy, my friend, for whom it's been far too long since we've caught up on this particular format. Christian, how are you doing surviving quarantine and thriving as we face this adversity?
I'm doing all right, Terry, and I have to admit, thank you very much for having me back on, and I've been looking forward to this, and I hope I have something to add for the people out there. But, you know, things are going okay. I'm at EWTN Catholic TV. I'm a writer and associate producer for the News Nightly program. Our show has continued throughout the whole pandemic, although we are able to work remotely. You know, so some challenges, but definitely taking the good with the bad, for sure.
And to the degree that this has given you a little bit more free time, you've decided to fill it by pursuing a project that has been multiple years in development, but has really kind of come to the light of day in a meaningful way for the first time this spring. And that is, in the wake of the cancellation of the 2020 NCAA tournament, you reached out to Editor-in-Chief Matt Kinnear and me and asked whether or not we were interested in, you know, trying to fill the void with tabletop lacrosse. And tabletop lacrosse is a dice and card game that uses the combination of real data with chance to recreate a lacrosse game. And you explain on InsideLacrosse.com's recap of the first round tournament matchups this weekend a little bit more detail about how a game is actually played. But to begin and set the table, anyone who's familiar with Stratomatic or other types of similar games, that's the inspiration for this, right?
Absolutely. You know, I was introduced to Stratomatic baseball when I was 12 years old and love those games. And it's funny too, you know, Lars Tiffany, the head coach at Virginia for lacrosse, used to play Stratomatic football. You know, there's a lot of devotees to these tabletop games, and not just Stratomatic, although I think those are the best and they are my favorite, but APBA or APBA games, I learned a little bit about later in life because they do a Premier League soccer game that's actually quite good, and European soccer in general. So it's sort of a childhood of, you know, sports games and Stratomatic, and also a company called Avalon Hill, which was based in Baltimore and had wonderful games. And a lot of anyone who's played the Avalon Hill sports games may recognize a few touches of Avalon Hill in tabletop lacrosse. But those were sort of the genesis. You know, I thought that I was somewhat positioned being loving the sport of lacrosse, being an enthusiast of the sport, but also having this background in so many different types of sports games that I just tried to sort of combine all of them into something that might work.
And so the foundation of the game is you create a card for each player on a roster. And for the purposes of this project, you started by creating the 2020 Army and Navy teams in order to play that game out. And then also worked with Brian Coghlan to forecast or seed a NCAA tournament team, and then you created those 16 teams rosters in order to play the first round and then subsequently quarterfinals, semifinals, and championship of the 2020 tabletop lacrosse season. And so essentially the game requires a deck of playing cards, 52 playing cards, right?
Actually, technically, it's 40.
Because
I take out the face card.
Yeah, okay, got it. Understood. And then two dice, two six-sided dice, one colored and one not colored. And then the roster cards for each team, correct?
Yes, and then there's also the fast action cards, which is a hat tip to Avalon Hill for that. So that is where the game engine, if you will. You know, you pick the fast action card, and it's divided into several categories. You know, action, which is sort of, okay, this person is trying to pass the ball to this person, or there's a ground ball, or this person has an open shot, or this person has a guarded shot. There's action. There's the ground balls are determined there. You know, players are given a grade, AAA through E on ground balls. And so it'll say, you know, defenseman one, if he's a B, he gets a ground ball. Sometimes it's defenseman one, excuse me, against attackman one, whoever's a higher rating gets it. So, you know, so there's ratings, there's things like that. There's advance, which I thought, you know, the longer a team has possession, the more likely the defense will break down. Although some defenses, it's more likely they'll cause a turnover. So action is almost always a guarded shot. If you can get through action once, you can, and we still have possession, then you go into an advance, which is a little bit of a better, you have more likelihood for an open shot in advance.
Okay.
So that, again, that mitigates somewhat trying to shoot quickly or, you know, so there is a difference And then also the players have ratings of 5, 3, and 1 for shooting. A 5 can shoot on almost any possession as long as the defender doesn't nullify the shot. And those are like Doc Aitken is a 5, for instance, whereas Peyton Cormier is a 1 because in my opinion, I think he kind of needs help to get his own. He just can't make his own shot as easily as Aitken can, or as easily as Moore, or as easily as Krause, speaking of Virginia. So Cormier is a 1 because his shooting number is much higher. He's his shots on goal percentage is significantly higher than Doc Aitken. So I didn't want to have the game be where Cormier could take 13 shots. Like, well, no, that's not really his game. Aitken can take 13 and Cormier probably takes 4.
Right.
So, and so that was how I tried to limit a crease attackman, for lack of a better term, or someone who has a very high percentage of shots but doesn't shoot very often. That was how I was trying to make sure that person doesn't take an inordinate number of shots, because I think that would obviously skew the game in the wrong direction.
Right. So the outcomes of the matchup between the players' cards, to the degree that that's a function of what happens, are determined by dice rolls and drawing of cards from the playing deck, correct?
Correct. Exactly. And actually, I do use 2 sets of non-face card playing decks. So it's 80 cards, just a little bit more variety, having learned from Strat-O-Matic Baseball. Once you draw that ace, once you draw that 1, if that's the only 1 in the deck, you're like, oh, that's not going to happen again. So I'm going to be a little bit more aggressive, or less aggressive, whatever it might be. If you know that there's a 2nd or a 3rd or a 4th one in there, I just think it randomizes it a little bit more.
And so those 80 cards are essentially what determines the clock, right? So in one run through the deck is the duration of a quarter.
Running through the fast action card deck.
Oh, okay.
The 1 quarter.
Got it. So how many fast action cards are there?
Very good question. I've created 64, but I only use between 40 and 48 per quarter, depending on, if it's 2 up-tempo teams like the Albany-Syracuse first round game, I think I use 46 per quarter. But for teams that don't shoot as much, I go with 40 or 42. And the reason I created more than I need is just, again, for variety's sake. I don't want the same cards kind of over and over. I also have something called the Z card. There's 4 Z cards, just the letter Z on it. It looks like the mark of Zorro on a card. But there is a Z, and that's where you get illegal stick penalties. That's where you get injuries to the guy who has to sit out for a half or for a whole full game. And again, I don't want 4 Zs every quarter. So by making 64 cards and only using 40 to 46 of them, that mitigates somewhat where the Zs can come in.
And so as these actions occur, I assume that you're taking notes as if this were a line by line in a box score, correct?
Exactly. I do have individual shots and turnovers have been tricky, and I do not keep individual ground balls. Just some of that is already built into the game, but everything else, shots, goals, assists, saves, cause turnovers, I do keep individually, and faceoff wins by team, I keep individually, and I could keep individual faceoff wins if I needed to. I just do it by team because it's easier. Most teams only have 1 faceoff specialist anyway. So I could create a pretty extensive box score if I had to or wanted to.
So this is one of the things that's so compelling about this is that it's differentiated from some of the other simulation events, games, seasons that we've seen, particularly in the wake of the cancellation. So Lax Reference, for example, has done a simulated season. And one of the things that I like about the tabletop lacrosse differentiation is that it incorporates both the real life, both fact-based and opinion-based functions of the game, but then also incorporates chance the way that in real life and in sports happens. Things that are unexplainable or unexpected yield results. And so, tabletop lacrosse can bring about outcomes that weren't expected. And so your example, the sequence that you highlighted in the wake of the first round of the tournament, I thought was really revealing in the way that that actually manifests in the way that it works. And so you described the end of the game between Virginia and Penn State. And it was interesting because Penn State had the ball. The game was tied. It was very late in the fourth quarter and they threw the ball out of bounds on the clear. And for me, that was a really strong impression because I just watched the 2019 NCAA semifinals in which Duke threw the ball out of bounds on the clear, and it
Right.
rang very true, and ultimately led to Virginia's game-winning goal, which is exactly what happened in this scenario as well, as the Cavaliers vanquished the Nittany Lions and moved on to the quarterfinals. So, what's your opinion on how much the randomness of and the chance of this is a part of the fun?
That's a good question. I think it's, for me, and it's funny, I guess we were watching different things, but had the same concept. The other day I was watching the 94 Virginia Syracuse semifinal. It was a 15-14 up and down. Virginia took 57 shots in regulation, and I think Syracuse had 71 ground balls in regulation. So it was just one of those really fun games to watch, a very visceral kind of fun. And I remember thinking to myself, and I wrote a little bit about this in an article for IL earlier this the spring after the cancellation, just that was what I was trying to capture with tabletop lacrosse. I was trying to capture how amazing the sport can be when it's a beautiful day and it's 70 degrees and it's a big crowd and it's an important game and these teams are going up and down and really giving everything they have, because this isn't college football or the NBA or college basketball, even March Madness. There's just an element to college lacrosse that is so unique and so different from every other college sport, because it's kind of big time and in some ways isn't. And that was what I was trying to capture with tabletop lacrosse. And honestly, yes, I'm its creator, but it's fun. I'm actually really having a lot of fun. And one of the things too, the reason I originally built it was my love of lacrosse and my love of sports board games and strategy and all that. The underlying reason was because I was trying to think of a way to come up with a quasi-scientific method for determining the best team of all time. The greatest team of the NCAA tournament era, at least I should say. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be fun to have, 77 Cornell play, 90 Syracuse or whatever it might be, just these great teams from the past. And I figured I was on the right path, because the first time I played the 76 Cornell team, actually, against 76 UMass, I was recreating a few of the 1976 teams, which I have stats. And the very first play of the game, McEnany hits French for a goal. And I thought, okay, I think I'm onto something. The rest of the game might stink. And just that sort of timelessness of everything, and I tried to capture it in one of my IL articles, and for the 2020 lacrosse season, Nick Mellon will always play for Syracuse. Ament will always play for Penn State. Sowers will always play for Princeton, just sort of the way that their careers for 4 years or 5 years in some cases were. And so that was what I was trying to capture. I was trying to capture what I think at essence makes the sport so fun, and that is the guy who's trying to shoot against the goalie trying to make the save, modified by the defender who can, a plus minus rating, make the shot harder, make the shot easier, take the shot away altogether in some cases. And there's just so few sports that have that kind of balance that I thought that, well, let me see if I can try to get that in some form for lacrosse, because probably like you and probably like anyone who's listening to this, once Memorial Day ends, I always found myself as much sad as anything else, because I knew I was going to miss the sport.
It's incredibly beautifully said. And I thought that in that article that you referenced, when you introduced that this was a project that you were taking under, I thought that that was so artful. The way that, I mean, the leaves on the trees is a huge part of the smell of the grass, the, crisp temperature of the air. These are all things that are a part of the reason that each of us, everybody listening to this podcast, loves lacrosse. And, it seems like that's a world away from a deck of cards and a bunch of, kind of handwritten player evaluations or assessments, for lack of a better word. But on the other hand, listeners can kind of judge for themselves how much this forthcoming conversation, when we're going to recap the outcomes of the first round of the tournament, makes them feel good in the absence of having the conversation on the basis of what actually happened on the field.
Yeah, well, but thank you for saying that, because that's the one thing, other than my own sort of, and I hope this comes across as not a vanity project as such, but if one person says, hey, you gave me a sense of closure, or hey, like, I really enjoyed your tournament, or there was obviously, I'm not saying that this is a replacement of the NCAA tournament. I am not saying whoever wins the tabletop lacrosse tournament should get a banner and all these, a ring and all these things for each player and coach. But if one person were to say like, hey, that was fun, or if one person were to say you gave me a sense of closure, like that would actually make me feel really good, because I don't know if this, how people, I'm not sure if this has ever really been tried in the sport of lacrosse before, and I'm honestly, I'm putting myself out there a little bit, because if this flops, people can say, oh, what the heck, that was awful. But I do think that at least thus far, I've been very lucky, and maybe I shouldn't be surprised given the people in our sport, but I've been very pleased and heartened and grateful that the feedback I've gotten has been, hey, you know, I'm really enjoying this. Or even the father of Navy's star attackman, Christian Daniel, his dad was a coach down in Southern Maryland, I think, but he reached out and said, he took it in the right spirit, you know, Army beat Navy 11-9. He said, oh, that was fake news. But then he laughed and he said, but I appreciate you're trying to give us something to smile about, you know, with the season having been canceled. And that was how I hope most people take it, not as some vanity project. And to be fair, tabletop lacrosse is not available for sale. I'm not sure it ever will be for a number of reasons. So I'm not trying to make a buck off this. I'm just trying to have a little bit of fun, and I hope people take it in the spirit in which it is intended.
Well, to that end, the coach of the defending national champions, and I spoke day, you know, on Wednesday night, and we talked about tabletop lacrosse, and he described reading your summary of his team's win over Penn State as like eating candy. You mentioned that Lars Tiffany played Stratomatic and other similar types of games growing up. And I learned this tidbit as well. The commissioner of his league was Donald M. Fisher, who wrote one of the historical books of lacrosse. So
sure, I have it. I think he's a Penn State professor.
Yep. The many different intersections of this situation are very interesting. But like I said, let's run through these results, and you know, the listeners can kind of determine for themselves how realistic this feels and how much it makes it feel like they're back, you know, on the Monday after the Monday after Mother's Day, thinking about the first weekend of college lacrosse NCAA tournament action. So in addition to the Cavaliers' 17-16 win, which was in regulation, correct?
It was in regulation, yes. I've not yet had an overtime game entering the quarterfinals.
So in subsequent to that, North Carolina 12, Maryland 11, the number 7 seeded Terrapins were leading 8-4 in the first half before the Tar Heels closed the deficit to 8-6 at halftime and then just reeled off a second half comeback that included Brian Cameron, who you identified as a 51, scored the winner in the final 2 minutes, assisted by Chris Gray.
Yes, and Cameron is a 51, but he's also a shot factor of 1, meaning he can only it's rare for him to get a shot. And in fact, 99% of the ones who get a shot have to go into that advanced category where I mentioned action in advance. It's very hard to get a shot for a 1 in the action. Again, because I think it's hard, you know, the crease attackman who has a very high shooting percentage but doesn't take that many shots. I was really trying to build that into the game where you couldn't have that guy take 14 shots because his shooting percentage is a 51 is very high. You wouldn't want Brian Cameron to take 14 shots. And frankly, I don't think he ever would in a game. That's not necessarily his role. So, yeah, he did score the winning goal, but I think it was only his third shot of the game to that point. Even with the 51, you would say, well, why doesn't he shoot more often? But again, that's not the way the Carolina offense works. That's not the way the sport works.
Right, right, right. So in the third game on the first day, I assume that these are in chronological order, Cornell beat Holy Cross. The Big Red were the number 2 seed. Holy Cross, the Patriot League automatic qualifier?
Yes. Because they had a top 15 RPI based on Brian Coughlin, and there was no other, you know, arguably Holy Cross's win over Harvard was the best Patriot League non-conference victory. And also just FYI, I did their chronological, except that that Penn State game was the last game because I tried to think, like, I tried to put on my ESPN producer hat.
Got it.
And I do work for a four-letter network that starts with E and ends in N, but it's the Catholic Network. It's not the sports leader network. But I did try to say, okay, if I were programming at ESPN, what games would I want when? And I just thought I would start with Carolina, Maryland, the two big name teams, and then finish with Penn State, Virginia. Again, teams that I thought a lot of people had heard of. So Penn State, Virginia was the fourth game.
Got it. So the Big Red were the number 2 seed, and they knocked off the Crusaders 15-7. Jeff Teat finished with 6 assists, and the Big Red scored 11 first half goals, shooting 50%.
Yes, which I'm proud of. And for the game, they shot 15-40, which again is right around their average. You know, they shot 40%, 41% for the season. So they were kind of right in that neighborhood, which I was proud of. And one thing I did not realize, two things about Holy Cross that I did not realize, was how aggressive and how good they are on cause turnovers, but also their faceoff guy. And I probably should have known that O'Connell was this incredible faceoff guy. Duke certainly knows, because it sounds like he's headed down there for his fifth year. But I was very impressed by what I learned about Holy Cross, watching film of them and studying their statistics, and also reaching out to a couple opposing coaches, you know, who was their best inside finisher, who's their best outside shooter. I did that for all 17 teams in the tournament, for the record, just because I didn't want to. I figured why it couldn't hurt to ask. So I tried to get sort of scouting reports on the teams and build my cards that way, not just empirical data, although I could have done just empirical data if I'd needed to. But Holy Cross did impress me much more than I was expected to be impressed by them.
In the, I suppose it would be third game on Saturday, Ohio State 15,
Yes.
St. Joe's 8. The Hawks closed the to an 8-7 late 8-7 deficit late in the third quarter before the number 3 seed Buckeyes pulled away.
And that, again, Trey LeClair, whose card is a very streaky card. He has a low shots on goal number, but a very high automatic goal number. And again, that was something I thought that makes lacrosse a little bit different from other sports. You know, look, I just having watched video of LeClair and say O'Keefe at Penn State, these incredible outside shooters who take shots and you say, well, that's the goal against any goalie. So that was why I did create, you know, I wanted to, again, I wanted Trey LeClair to be able to take a shot that was unstoppable. And I thought that as long as every shot of his was a shot that the goalie would have a chance of saving, there is no, they all would have at least some chance of being stopped.
Sure.
So I thought, well, no, let me give him a certain, and a lot of the players have this, to be fair, but LeClair and O'Keefe in particular have, I think for O'Keefe, I think it's 11 to 21, and LeClair is like 11 to 22, something like that, or maybe those are reversed. But any of those roles are automatic goals. And LeClair had some of those, but he started 0 for 7. And again, I think he's a little bit streaky, and he's incredibly effective, but I think he's streaky. So I was sort of, you know, breaking my arm, patting myself on the back. But he started 0 for 7 and finished 5 for 7. I thought, well, I actually think that might have happened.
Transitioning to Sunday, the top-seeded Yale Bulldogs top Marist 13-6. Marist, I should have mentioned this, emerged as the play-in game winner over Richmond at midweek.
Yes, 8-7, which was lower scoring than I thought it would be. And when they played in the regular season, Richmond won 13-10. So draw your own conclusions. But anyway, I did come up, and having used that game was part of the reason I thought Marist would win faceoffs, which they did with Peyton Smith. Then they would have played a much slower tempo. And, you know, this game was, I think, the playing game, they each had below 40 shots, which I thought was exactly what Marist would do if they played again. And then in the Yale game, Marist finished with 29 shots, probably because Yale's defense is very good. I remember I said defenders can, they have a plus minus rating, but there's also an area whereby they can have you not take a shot at all. And Yale has a lot of those numbers. It's called an NS rating, or no shot. You know, again, a 1 through 20. So like Fake, I think Chris Fake is like a 1 through 11, 19 and 20. If you take that, if you pick up a card as a 1 through 11, 19 or 20, and Fake is starting, you can't take a shot. You have to just move on to the next FAC because she successfully stopped you from taking a shot. And that's kind of my, I had a long talk about this at one of the Final Fours probably 15 years ago. You know, one of the things that make defensemen, you can say, well, he held his attackman to two assists. But to me, and it was Steve Dubois, who used to do, he was a Division III lacrosse sports information guy, was fantastic. He knew everything. He was, I love talking with him, Stephen Marcy. And Steve always said, you know, the real value of a defender isn't just that he held this guy to two assists, but what if he only held him to one shot? You know, you can hold the guy to two assists, but if he takes 10 shots, maybe he had an off game, maybe the goalie played out of his mind. You know, you didn't necessarily play a great game on defense, but if you hold the guy to two assists and he only takes one shot, you've played a very good game on defense. And so I tried to build that in as well. But again, not, you know, I'm trying to think off the top of my head. North Carolina gives up a lot of shots per game, I think. They're the one I'm thinking of. So their NS ratings are not that good. But obviously Fake and Georgie Bond at Princeton have very high NS ratings because I think they're the best defenders in the game. And so you're going to struggle to even take a shot against any of them. And Fake adds something because when he's guarding you, you go from a 5 automatically to a 3. And if you're a 3, you go to a 1. So when he guards Matt Moore on Saturday, Moore, who is a 5 and normally would shoot anytime he wanted, now is a 3, and he has to try to get through Fakes 1 through 11, 19 to 20 to just take a shot. But again, I think that that is something that makes lacrosse a little bit different from basketball or hockey.
I think that's one of the most interesting revelations of this game, and it's popularizing thinking about the sport in a particular way, in a way that's probably different from the way that most people think about it. And it really, to your point, comes down to the balance between offense and defense. You know, and
Yes,
certainly
exactly.
The game absolutely changes by virtue of the shot clock, because prior to the shot clock, essentially, the way that the defense won the possession was the offense made a mistake, such, you know, throwing the ball out of the bounds or dropping the ball and having the defense pick up the ground ball. The defense, and this became rarer and rarer over a 30-year span, pressed out and took the ball away. Or the offense took a shot that was saved, or, you know, in less frequent cases was
backed up. Or not backed up, right.
Yeah. Obviously, shot clock completely changes that. If you prevent the opposing team from getting a quality look for 80 seconds, you are rewarded with the ball. You know, that's why coaches routinely say that the shot clock is actually, you know, people think about it as this thing that promotes offense, but it's actually a tool for the defense, much more so than it is in any way an asset for the offense. But, like, I always think about defense, and I don't know. One of my favorite movies growing up was Speed, the Keanu Reeves, Jeff Daniels.
Sure, I've seen it.
Yeah.
It's called the Wildcat, right?
Sandra 100%. Bullock. 100%. Yep. And there's a Dennis Hopper line where he talks about how a bomb disposal technician's responsibility is to prevent the bomb from becoming. And that's always the way that I've thought about defense. Like, it is to prevent a goal from happening is to prevent the bomb from becoming. And it's weird because you have to, you know, celebrating a stop is so much different from celebrating a goal, in the sense that, like, you're celebrating the absence of something. And but at the same time, like, the equivalent of an assist in defense is like either turning back a dodge or preventing a shot from being taken,
right?
Like putting an offensive player in a position where the best decision for him is to pass the ball and transfer the onus of shooting or passing or making a play to someone else. That is how you kind of, when you're individual matchup defensively. But one of the things that's interesting is that you can sacrifice the collective by focusing on your individual, right? Like, you could win all of your individual matchups and yet be a net negative or a detriment for your defense because you aren't doing the other 5/6 of your job as effectively or attentively as you should be. And that's one of the biggest things that Jerry Byrne harps, is that you spend 5/6 of a possession of, you know, on average, you're going to be off ball 5/6 of the time. So that is where 5/6 of your success is going to come from. So I don't know. That was a little rambling, and it didn't necessarily culminate in a point or an idea. But do you have a response or a thought?
Yes, and I agree. And to be fair, not every one of the FACs, you know, you can't have that X rating. It's called an X rating. I cannot have Chris Fakes 1 through 11, 19, and 20 be called into play on every single time he's guarding Matt Moore. It has to be called in by an X rating. And to be fair, most of the cards are X ratings, but there are some, like the end of the Virginia Penn State game, with an SH rating, where the guy, I liken that to a pass or a pick, or the defense was moving, whatever, and that the offensive player can get his hands free. Now Fakes -8 is still in a play, but he cannot take away the shot. So there are a few times where an SH card, as opposed to an X card, Matt Moore would be able to take a shot, as long as it says 3 SH or 1 SH and not 5. But no, I agree. I just found that I didn't want to overemphasize the ability of someone to negate a shot, but I didn't want to neglect it either. And again, I don't think that skill exists as such in basketball. You know, I think you would steal the ball, Kawhi Leonard can make a shot very uncomfortable and probably thwart the vast majority of them, but I don't think he stops people from shooting necessarily.
Right.
Whereas Fake obviously does.
Moving on, UMass 10, Providence 9. Chris Gabrielli taking on one of his mentors in Greg Cannella. Were the Friars the Big East AQ, or did they get in as an at-large?
They were the Big East AQ. They actually had the 4 RPI, according to Brian Coughlin. And as I did my research, you know, one of the coaches told me their Providence goalie, Bergdorf, might be the best goalie in the country. I know he was an honorable mention All-American on the IL media. And certainly for my purposes, Georgetown or Providence, you know, the Georgetown undefeated, but the RPI was in the 20s. Providence had at least one or two losses, but the RPI was 3 or 4. And I thought, well, no, I think I'll take the, you know, I don't think a top 5 RPI has ever missed the NCAA tournament. So that was why I went with Providence. And also, I sort of backed it up by the NCAA bean counter saying, oh, if Providence wins, they could just go right to that quarterfinal at Brown and we have a sellout. You know, and not that Amherst is all that far. I mean, I think UMass probably would have brought people too, but that is sort of how I deduced that or divined that. And Brian Coughlin says, well, if it's a Syracuse Providence, then maybe they should just play at Madison Square Garden, like an old Big East style, but it wound up not to be.
So yeah. How did the Minutemen come out on top?
A little bit. The dice were not kind to the Minutemen through three quarters, 4 for 29 shooting. Again, some of that is because Providence is a great goalie, very good short stick, Demidian Shaw, very good long stick in Jennings, who's a junior and will be back. Bergdorf is either a sophomore or a junior, so he'll be back too. But then the fourth quarter, you know, UMass hit a couple. They got a couple of rolls, 11s and 12s are almost always goals, or at least a shot on goal. And UMass has this very hard shooting middies, Phil Potts, Trainer, guys like that, and they started getting low rolls and they started scoring, and then all of a sudden it became a shootout, and UMass wound up winning 10-9.
Continuing on, Syracuse 18, Albany 6. This would have been the rematch of a game in which the Orange went to Albany for the first time in the history of this series. But this game was played in, well, not the Carrier Dome, but it was played in Syracuse, as the fourth seeded Orange displayed a deep offense and the ability to win faceoffs and make saves, a traditional formula that is usually pretty successful.
Yeah, Drake Porter was the revelation to me, because Albany actually generated some pretty good looks. You know, the Albany defense was not a top 50 defense, so they had very few NSs, for instance, and their plus minus ratings I thought were a little bit lower because they do give up a lot of goals, but they score goals too, and that was where Porter came in and played very well. I think he had 12 saves for the game, but I actually have the box score right in front of me. He had 9 in the first half, so when Syracuse jumped to that early 8-2 lead, Porter had 9 saves in that first half to kind of get Syracuse going. And you know, the fourth quarter, it was only 2-2. So Syracuse, it wasn't like Syracuse ran it off. You know, at the end of the three quarters, I put in a lot of the reserves for Syracuse, and they didn't really score that much. But I just thought, I think it's a combination of the fact that Albany ran into a very hot goalie, because they would normally score more than 6. But I thought the 18 Syracuse scored is about right. They have a pretty effective offense.
I would agree. And in the last of the 8 games, in the first round of the NCAA tournament, Princeton 15, Villanova 9, I mean, this was the story of the season, right? The Tigers' resurgence. Muggle Sauer's get an opportunity to play in May for the first time, and he extends his career one more game as the Tigers advance to the quarterfinals.
I had gotten a tweet from John Cornell, whom I've known for years. He's a great guy, really knows a lot about sports. And he said, interesting, Princeton's the best team in the country, and you have them as a 6 seed. And I kind of like, all right, I'll let you get away with that one. And then when it was 6-0 at the end of the first quarter, I thought, maybe Cornell isn't as dumb as I thought he was. And Cornell, if you're listening, I actually don't think you're dumb. But anyway, but what was funny, again, it's the dice. You know, 11, I was telling Jerry Price this, Princeton had 2 11s and a 12 in the first quarter, and Villanova had 3 65s or 66s, which is an automatic save and a fast break the other way. So, you know, and again, it's not perfect, but I was like, well, no, Princeton at home, Cyrus' first NCAA game. Like, maybe they would have really been fired up. Maybe they would have really been unhappy at that 6 seed if they think they're the best team in the country and undefeated and, you know, some decent wins. I could see why they would make that argument. It didn't come out of anywhere, or nowhere, I should say. So I was kind of like, all right, that's again, I could sort of, that stands to reason at the very least. I didn't think it was something that was completely inane. Villanova might think it was inane, but I actually thought it kind of made sense. And then Villanova came back. You know, they started getting some low rolls with their shooting midfielders and close to 8-6 and 10-7. So, again, I think these are things that aren't perfect, but I think it stands to reason.
And it's set up a quarterfinal Saturday at Hofstra, the first game, noon, North Carolina versus Cornell, the second game, Virginia versus Yale, and then Sunday at Brown, noon, Princeton versus Ohio State, the second game, UMass versus Syracuse. I'll tell you what, that sounds like a very legitimate, very possible quarterfinal weekend that you and I probably would have been making the drive north in order to get
through the
Bell Parkway by, I don't know, what time do we need to get past there? Like 10, 9:30 in order to make it to the game on time? Do you think that we would have been in, you know, puddles and puddles of rain the way that we were? What was that, the 2018 quarterfinals or the 17 quarterfinals?
It was 18, yeah. I think it was 18 when Yale beat Loyola. and Albany. Although the rain held off, I think, for that second game, that Albany game.
The Albany-Denver game, yeah.
But Albany-Denver, exactly. A, we would have been there, but B, I think we were due some decent weather, although I think in certainly for the first round games, if they'd been played, as you noted, the Cornell game was played in snow. I mean, I think it was desperately cold all up and down the East Coast on last Saturday, although Sunday I think it improved. But we are due some good weather, so I think the weather at Hofstra, had the games been there this weekend, would have been perfect.
So let me ask you this. How long does it take to get through a game?
It takes about an hour. Now, when I tweet updates, that obviously adds to it, but I can do it in between 45 minutes and an hour.
And is it as fun as you hoped it was going to be?
Yes. I have to admit it is. And again, part of it is just the fact that the sport kind of can linger on a little bit. I wouldn't say it lives on, but it lingers a little bit. You know, you're able to play these guys. And even going back to, you know, the 80s, I'm trying to a little bit of an 85 season. I found some stats here and there. You know, Del Dressel and Larry Quinn and some of these great Hopkins players and Brad Kotz for Syracuse. You know, Syracuse never played Brown. How would that game have gone? Because Brown has done a very good job of putting statistics on their website, as has North Carolina. And Ernie at Hopkins always sends me, and Stacey at Navy have been very kind by sending me stuff. So that's the biggest challenge, actually, is finding stats. Once I find the statistics, and of course, those teams don't have the shots on goal that I need, because again, it's the shots on goal, not just shooting percentage. So I have a little bit of a formula for in the absence of a shots on goal metric. But, you know, again, no, it's fun. It's amazing. And again, I do think at some point I would love to do a top 17, you know, a tournament of the all-time great teams. You know, how would 2013 Duke have done against 90 Syracuse or 85 Johns Hopkins? So I think that is in the offing at some point soon, probably. But I just saw sort of an opening with the 2020 season having been canceled. And I appreciate your guys' faith in me and letting me, you know, a little bit of a wing and a prayer here. But at least so far, I hope people are enjoying it.
Well, I certainly enjoyed this conversation, Christian. As always, it was great to catch up. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
On the Inside Lacrosse podcast, everybody who is interested in how this weekend's quarterfinals shake out, follow Christian on Twitter at Sweezy Lacrosse. Do you have any predictions?
Pain. No, I'm kidding. That was Rocky 3, I think. But again, I'm just trying to, you know, make sure the shots are right, see how the dice are rolling. And I'm excited to see how it goes because it has been fun so far.
Well, if you like what you heard, leave a rating and review, tell a friend, and Sweezy, we will have you back as we advance towards the Final Four.
I would love that.
And NCAA Championship to talk about how all of this has unfolded.
Awesome, Terry. Thank you. I would love that.